You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about an interesting paper published in Science called Forbidden Knowledge. And let me explain what that means. Remember Alfred Kinsey, the pioneering sex researcher? Well, he was not a very popular scientist after his groundbreaking work on sexual practices was published in 1948. He sort of broke an unwritten taboo about what kinds of research to stay away from, and in those days, that included doing sex research. Some of the century's most noted and perhaps infamous researchers have been the ones that did work that made people feel, well, uncomfortable, like Kinsey's sex studies or Milgram's research into the psychology of control. And this paper called Forbidden Knowledge, which appears in these journal Science, takes a look at some areas of research that are constrained, and not just by laws and regulations such as the restrictions on the federal funding of embryonic stem cell research, for example, but research that's sort of more subtle, restrained subtly by public opinion or a researcher's own fears, stuff they might want to study, but, you know, I better not go there. John Murr is assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics in the School of Medicine and senior fellow in the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, published a study in Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Aaron.
Forbidden Knowledge. Did it take you a while to think of that title?
Actually, Forbidden Knowledge has been around in the philosophy of science literature for some years. And in fact, there was a really interesting book written after the Asilomar conference back in 1975 about the limitations on science. And that, the Asilomar conference was an attempt by molecular biologists to get ahead of state and municipal efforts at the time to limit recombinant DNA technologies.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's sort of going on now in stem cell research.
Right. In fact, there's been a recent call for another Asilomar, if you will.
Yeah. But what I find interesting is in your paper here, you say that was sort of you can cope with that. When you have the political side of science, that is sort of out in the open. We can talk about it. It can get debated. We may be able to change laws that change regulations. That's sort of the easy stuff.
Sure. Although, also, the Asilomar kind of regulation, the effort by scientists to regulate themselves in such an explicit way is very rare.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and the same stuff politically I'm speaking, I'm talking about stem cell research, you know, things like that today.
Right.
What you do point out is, and I'll quote from your paper, "We were surprised, however, that respondents felt most affected by what we characterized as informal constraints. Researchers sometimes only knew that they had encountered forbidden knowledge when their research breaches an unspoken rule and is identified as problematic by legislators, news agencies, activists, editors, or peers."
Right.
So that was what the Kinsey study was, basically?
Sure. Until the book was published, I imagine that most scientists didn't really know what was going on, and the state and the police probably didn't really understand fully what was going on. A lot of people responded the same way, that, you know, scientists, when they try to publish or they submit a proposal, that's when it's subjected to peer review to editors and the like, and that gives their peers an opportunity to kind of give them some pretty directed feedback. In some way, what scientists were telling us about was their own perceptions of the kinds of things that they could get away with. So it was their perceptions of both the constraints or the restraints placed both from within science, what their peers and the editors and funders would do, but also the greater pressures from social organs, such as, you know, in the extreme case, Congress. And there are clear examples of that, like in the cloning area, but as well as activist groups, and even sometimes just the idea of press coverage.
Give us an idea of some of these informal constraints and things they would like to do but felt they shouldn't.
Well, one of the funny things about forbidden knowledge is we really can't talk too explicitly about the examples that people gave us, because it could be outing of our subjects. But people talked about, for instance, some of the things that people talked about, the kinds of research that they would like to do that wouldn't be done, would be research, for instance, on marijuana. You know, any research that could potentially show that marijuana isn't as dangerous as is politically palatable as would be unpalatable, unfundable research. Mm-hmm. Issues of sex, and whenever sex is raised, it always raises a lot of flags. Homosexuality is a flag by itself. Other areas touched on race and culture or gender and performance measures, where people would be very careful, they wouldn't either touch it with a 10-foot pole, and some people even said that they avoided doing gender research, for instance, because it was just too politically sensitive. Others basically said that they couched their research in really sensitive and careful ways to make sure that they weren't kind of concluding something that would really get someone upset.
I remember a few years ago, there was a book called, what was it, The Bell Curve?
Yes, The Bell Curve. Lots of people, lots of our subjects kind of raise The Bell Curve as an example of the kind of research that can raise controversy. And the issue is whether or not The Bell Curve should have been published. And I think most of our respondents and most scientists will say, yes, it should be published. It's controversial, but publishing it allows others to criticize it. And I mean, one of the things, one of the greatest concerns I have about what we've found, where, you know, some scientists say sometimes results are so, you know, they could be misused, or they could gore someone's ox or something, that they'd prefer not to publish it. And there are clear cases where they didn't publish. My concern is that they were, nonetheless, they would talk to us about it, and they talk to their colleagues, and they may talk about it at conferences, and it becomes kind of a general knowledge in the community without having been subjected to peer review. So its reliability is probably less reliable, but nonetheless, the information is still out there, and I think that's actually potentially more damaging that way.
Yeah, in your paper you say several researchers said that their choices to study yeast or mice instead of dogs was guided by fears of retribution from animal rights groups.
Right, and there are cases where the animal rights groups have put a lot of pressure on people. There was, I think, at the University of Iowa a number of years ago, the head of the animal lab there just stepped down and said, I've had enough of this. He was getting death threats, and that was, he just walked away from it. And we had some people who just chose to not, as one, when we quoted one person, who just wants to, you know, he doesn't want to simplify his life in a sense.
Yeah, you said, one respondent said, quote, I would like to lunatic-proof my life. As much as possible.
Yeah, it was kind of cute.
I'd love to see some of the comments you didn't put in this.
It's a short version of the paper. We have lots of quotes like that. And another person, for instance, one of the things we talked about is, you know, the idea that there are formal constraints placed by Congress and the like, and that these were informal and internal constraints. People, I think, across the board didn't like the idea that society is making decisions for science. They would prefer that science regulate itself. But again, science doesn't do that in a very good way. Mm-hmm. But one person said, you know, that the kind of the limitations placed on stem cell research, I think, is what he was talking about. Said he just, it was just typical of American Yahoo politics.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have people concerned about genetic engineering of possibly a terrorist bug, you know, that might be used.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we actually chose people who are working in areas that could be potentially sensitive either from a national defense perspective or from a social perspective. And a number of the immunologists talked about the issue of making a more dangerous bug. And one person, kind of, a quote was, you know, everyone knows, there's an unwritten rule, everyone knows that they shouldn't make a more dangerous or more pathogenic bug. And nonetheless, I mean, there are cases out there where people have done it. Now, there was a study about 2 or 3 years ago, I think out of Australia, where they made a more pathogenic mouse pox, and that was published.
Yeah.
Now, today, we did, and people responded, and it was like, but not on that specific example, but they said, you know, before 9/11, if you found something like this, you'd say, that's really cool, and you'd publish it. But nowadays, you either won't ask the question or you'll shy away from the question, which may be difficult because you may find it out anyway by mistake, and they won't publish.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. David in Fairbanks. Hi, David.
Hi. I'm a grad student in biology here in Fairbanks, and I've, this is really hard even just to bring up, but I've often wondered if we could isolate a gene or genes that may code for homosexuality. And I know you only can take my word for this, but I don't wish to ascribe any value to this, but I can certainly understand how people would be afraid of that. However, it seems like one of those things that we just need to know. And as a biologist, I can separate myself and say, it's not really important. We all have quote unquote mutated genes. So it's not like you're now diseased when we identify this, but it would certainly be good to know.
Sure. I mean, people, there have been efforts out there looking for genes. It's a very controversial topic. There was, some years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was a planned meeting, I believe, at the University of Maryland, just about the topic. And I think the meeting came under such intense political pressure, they just canceled the meeting outright. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those sensitive questions. One of the questions, things that we heard people talking about in our study was when they proposed to do something like this, but that, it wasn't this specific example, but something where you wonder about the scientific value. I mean, you wonder at the public policy value of a discovery like this. So what would you do differently? What would happen socially with this kind of result? And something that scientists and the public at large needs to ask.
Yeah. 1-800-9- Thank you, David.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. You know, there have been charges that this administration is more hostile to scientists or works harder to shoehorn them into agreeing with official line, you know, global warming, things like that.
Sure.
Did you see evidence of that in your study?
People mentioned the current political environment when they were talking to us. I don't see, just looking at our results and the people's responses, I don't see any specific examples that they talked about where they were constrained. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were aware of the political environment. And, you know, of course, I think you're aware that the UCS just published a report within the last couple of days showing how the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, some of the people, you know, the scientists who work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, that, feel that they have been, and their own science has been, constrained by the administration.
They're forbidden to talk to people.
Yeah, that was actually a really fascinating part of it.
Did you see that study? It's the Union of Concerned Scientists study just released 2 days ago.
Right.
Want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I looked at it, but my concern about it was that it was a very low response rate. It was less than 30% response rate, but it was a survey of over 1,000 biologists and other scientists who work for the service. And I guess, I mean, I didn't read the details, but apparently the Fish and Wildlife Service Administration came out and told scientists not to respond, not even on their own time. Now, well, that's not a forbidden knowledge. I don't know.
You can see why the response rate was so low.
Well,
they were forbidden to respond to it.
Well, it's funny because I'm sure they were anonymous responses, and how would the administration even know? But nonetheless, it means it suggests that there's a strong kind of response bias. People who did respond were more likely to criticize, be critical. So the fact that their response rates, you know, they got 50% of the respondents said that they had been told to misreport or otherwise kind of not be honest with their science. So I guess in some sense, if they're telling the truth, I mean, because they are biased, they could be answering for political gain. But if they are telling the truth, it's still 15% of those scientists. So, I mean, that is a source of concern.
Mm-hmm. Talking with John Mertz, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics in the School of Medicine and senior fellow in the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, about studying this issue of science. We're talking about forbidden knowledge. That's on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Was there any one question that kept popping up, that one area that people wanted to talk about that they, you know, maybe it's, you know, a little point somewhere that people kept saying over and over again, I wish we could do this study, but I'm not the one to suggest it. Don't put my name down.
No, there were some. I mean, people were, and I have to say that in discussing this with scientists, I mean, in some sense, scientists said, yeah, this kind of thing, suppressing results or modifying your methods to avoid politically sensitive issues, it was fairly common. But on the other hand, when you ask scientists what they do, it's very hard for them to intuit what they don't do and why they don't do it. So it took us a lot of time and a lot of talking to people to get them to start thinking about their own experiences and those of their colleagues.
And as you say, it's a hard thing to get someone to tell you what they don't want to talk about.
Right. Yeah. And right. And in fact, one of the people at one point during the interview, he does research with animals, and Joanna Kempner was doing the interview, and he said, you know, how do I know who you are? Are you at your desk? Please send me an email right now, because he said, for all I know, you could be an animal activist getting ready to raid the place.
Wow. Or my boss.
Just checking up on me.
You know, I was putting that ad in the newspaper for your own job and seeing who gets it. 1-800-989-8255. Diane in Philly. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'm sorry that I'm repeating to some extent what your first caller talked about, but as a mom, I'm real curious, and I never see this addressed very fully, in whether and if and so forth there's any impact on a person's developing as a homosexual of parenting practices, everything from influences in the womb in terms of hormones, stress hormones, and so forth, to breastfeeding and attachment parenting. You know, what does any of this have any impact? You, you hear about it in terms of mouse studies, masculinization of embryonic mice, and then, you know, it doesn't seem to get carried any further. And that's the kind of thing that parents are certainly concerned about. No matter how we feel about tolerance, we'd like to know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. We didn't talk to anybody who had raised that issue at all, and it does raise some questions about whether or not somebody would be working in that area. Would they be willing to submit a grant application to the NIH to fund that kind of research, and would, you know, how would it be received? There, you know, when you're talking about sex and homosexuality specifically, and it raises flags. I mean, last year there was an U.S. Congress, in fact, it was in the House of Representatives, there was a list of about 160, I think, studies that were flagged by some, I believe there were some religious interest groups out there that flagged these studies as being of questionable scientific merit. The studies had all been funded and were all had been gone through scientific peer review. And nonetheless, you know, the Congress was questioning those. And in fact, I believe the House voted to defund two projects that the NIH had funded. I don't think it came to anything because the projects were completed. I'm not sure how that worked out, but that was the case. One of our subjects actually told us that a colleague had submitted some research, and I believe homosexuality was an issue and sexual practices, and he was told by his NIH program chair, the program head of the program, to change the title of the grant because he didn't want to raise any flags. So these are things. The NIH will shy away from them because they don't want attention either, because they're the ones who get called on the carpet before Congress.
Yeah. Well, John Morrison, thank you very much for taking time to talk
with
us.
My pleasure.
Is there a full study published someplace besides the letter here?
We're currently writing it up and hope to have it out by the summer.
Thank you very much. John Morrison, assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics and School of Medicine and senior fellow at Center for Bioethics, University of Pennsylvania. Thank you for taking time to talk with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about open source biotechnology. You know, they've got open source computer programs where they get shared among everybody for nothing. How about open source biotechnology where all the tools get shared by everybody? It's happening. We'll talk about it. Stay with us.